Hi, everybody. I'm Kirk, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Fred for getting me into this. I think he had something to do with this. That's what you do when you've been around here for a while. You point the finger at somebody else when the speaker doesn't show up. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I am grateful to be sober tonight. You know, I know some of you will gag when you hear somebody say that, but as you hear how my life went, my life is wonderful today because of the principles that I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank Robin for sort of taking that commitment. That was right on. All right, appreciate that. That's what we do around here. We get into action, and I'm just sober because of the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. And how I came to that realization that I needed something in my life was a long, slow process. And it kind of started off with growing up in an alcoholic household. My parents were both alcoholics, but that's not the reason that I'm an alcoholic. But I just like to share a little bit of what it was like during my childhood, because you know, by the time I got to that point where I was in junior high school and kids were starting to mess around with pot and drinking, I didn't really know how uncomfortable I was. But when I did find something that made me feel better, I did it regularly. And I grew up, I said my parents were both alcoholics. You know, I can remember from a young age, we had those big cars back in the 50s, and driving around corners, and you could just hear the bottles rolling around underneath the car. And, you know, it was like music almost. It was, you know, as you were going, especially if you were going down the curves and stuff like that, it was kind of wild. And but I didn't really know what kind of problems it was. I know that my parents fought a lot. I remember one time I was real young, my dad coming home and telling my mom to make some coffee that he'd gotten in an accident. And you know, you're a kid, you don't think too much about this stuff. But you know, things started happening so that it just started getting worse with them. And we had a house that we bought, one of the first houses in a tract in Anaheim. In the 50s, it was close to Disneyland. Disneyland wasn't quite built yet, so I'm real young here. And but for some reason, we had to move, and we ended up in an Airstream trailer up in Altadena that belonged to my grandmother. And so it was my little brother, my dad, my mom, and me in this thing that was probably about as big as 15 feet long or something like that. And what I remember that had a real impact on me was like my dad coming home and banging on the doors, trying to get me to unlock the door to let him in. And my mom's like, no, don't let him in, he's drunk again, you know, you can't do that. And I don't know about you, but I just it did have some sort of an impact on me, and I just turned into kind of a fearful sort of a kid. But, you know, just kind of gliding along, my parents ended up getting to the point where they couldn't keep jobs. And so the family got together, and they decided that my brother and I needed to go and live with an aunt and uncle who were willing to take care of us for a few years. And my mom and dad, my mom went to her her sister's house, and my dad went to Skid Row in L.A., and we went to Florida to build a mobile home park. And I was 10 years old, and it was just bitching because it was like the first time in my life that, you know, I went to school on a regular basis medical care, you know, just it was good. I started getting into playing basketball, just doing kid things. We lived on a body of water, and we had a 10-foot boat, and we used to just be able to cruise through all these mangroves. It was just really nice, and we had a good time. And we spent 4 years there. It was kind of cool in Florida because I was the kid who was from California. And for some reason, that was some sort of a big deal. And, you know, I didn't know that I had an inferiority complex, but it was just kind of nice to feel like you were sort of better than, or people made you feel better than. And so I don't remember drinking down there. I did not drink that I remember in Florida up until, and I moved back here when I was about 14, but I remember sneaking off and smoking. And my parents got it together. My brother and I moved back here with my parents, and they had an apartment in Glendale, and we just started. I was in junior high school, started in, got a couple of friends, just what I did notice, like, my parents seemed to be kind of trying to make up for lost time, and they'd buy us whatever we wanted within reason. You know, I remember having skateboards. If I asked for anything, I got it, and bought a reel-to-reel stereo for Christmas and all this good stuff. And then not long after this, a couple of friends of mine, these two friends of mine that there was like the three amigos of us, I found out they had smoked pot when weekend, and of course when I found out they had done that, I had to do it. And I don't remember too much about that. It really wasn't that big of a deal. I don't remember getting hungry or anything like that. Around this time, I vaguely remember going to a party and there was alcohol around, but I didn't really want to have anything to do with alcohol because of what it had done in our family's life. And so I kind of I don't even remember doing it. I remember alcohol being around there, but I remember it wasn't too long after this. I'd gone from junior high school, ninth grade, into the 10th grade, and there was football games, and I would get somebody to, we went down and we got some drunk to buy us some beer, and we went up to this place called G Hill and drinking it, and you know, no big deal. I didn't really think it was that big a deal. I didn't, like, have a drink and it went down in my stomach and life was beautiful or anything like that. I don't remember any big deals happening from it, but it was just kind of a peer pressure sort of thing at that time. I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous and I respect the traditions here, but I did use a few outside issues out there, and I'll mention the one time that I remember distinctly that was like a crossing point for me compromising my values in life. And that was I went to school one morning and this guy said he had these 10 pills, and they were big white pills. And I remember taking a couple of them and feeling very good. And by the end of the day, I had taken all 10 of them and I was feeling just great. And I was talking, and I remember I had to go to the dentist, and I was trying to talk to him while he's he's drilling on me and that kind of stuff. And I think that that feeling had an impact on me because for some reason I made a decision that I was going to do that again as often as possible. And I had some, it seemed like these buddies of mine had older brothers and they were into drugs, and we had one other friend, and he was a couple years older than us, and he was, I don't know, probably looking at it like he's just like, you know, we're all having a good time, and we'd go buy pot from him and stuff like that. And one day I went over to his house, and he had this stuff. He was called it methamphetamine, and I didn't know what that was. And he said, well, the stuff's so potent, you know, you really can't snort it, and the best way to do it is to inject it. And I said, okay, you know, it's like 15 years old, you know, just I'll try anything once, you know, twice if it feels good. And the way the story goes is after I did that stuff, I had to get some more of that on a regular basis. And, you know, all my principles, you know, I never was much of a liar, a cheat, and a thief. My head is not that good without some speed in it, but, you know, trying to lie to my mom and people around me and keep my lies straight, I just was not good at it. So, but I did have to protect my right to use what I wanted to use. And I think As I look back on it now, and I have looked back as I've worked the steps, I was an uncomfortable little kid, and I was an uncomfortable young adult, and you know, when I put those drugs in my system, it just made me feel like a part of. It made me feel like I could socialize with people, but it wasn't long before I was overshooting the mark, and I was beginning to get a lot of antisocial behavior. And so what I'm doing now, I'm up all night, I'm doing this stuff, I'm out all night roaming the streets because I'm, you know, climbing through my bedroom window, and I'm going through people's cars, and finally somebody showed me how to hotwire Volkswagens. So I can't believe this is lame. I bought a stolen Volkswagen for a piece of stereo equipment or something like that. And but I, from that experience, I learned how to steal cars. And so you know, it kind of goes on here. I just like to relate my first arrest. And then it kind of goes on for the next 10 years with one miserable, demoralizing thing after another. But the first time I got arrested that afternoon, we broke into that friend of mine's house that got me off the first time on that speed. We stole all his drugs. We went and hid it somewhere. And then we all went home, had some dinner. We all met again. We went back to get those drugs. And we got some of them, but somebody must have seen where we stashed them, because that night, after roaming around all night, we came back to a Jack in the Box, and we switched cars. And as we left the Jack in the Box, the police started chasing us. And we're in a like a 1949 Hudson. This thing's just huge, you know, and we're like rolling around down in the bottom of this thing, throwing stuff out the window, you know what I mean, and trying to split it up so that it'll be harder for them to find, you know. And they've got the guns drawn, and so this is 17-year-old excitement that I'm having, you know. And I'm thinking, yeah. But really, when I ended up in jail and I knew I was in trouble with my parents, it was just like what I remember is that first foxhole prayer of, you know, God, if you just get me out of this one, I swear I'll go home and I'll get rid of all those drugs in my bedroom, and I won't do this again. And so I got out the next day, and I went home, and my mom had found all those drugs, and I was really bummed about that. But as I was saying, it just kind of goes along like this. My defiant attitude just kept developing, and I nurtured it, constantly. I don't know if it was because I was trying to feel, you know, like a big man, whatever it was. I just got arrested for a bunch of Volkswagens. I went in front of a judge in downtown L.A., and my mom drove me down there, and she could not believe that when I got called up, though, I just had this defiant look on my face, like, you know what, just give me whatever you got. I'll get it done, and I'll be on my way. And that judge did give me 30 days that time, but he, for some reason, said, I'm going to give you a week on the streets to take care of your business. And that was his first mistake, because my only business was just getting high. And during that week, I took some Reds, and I fell out on somebody's lawn out in Burbank and got arrested one more time. And so I'm going to court while I'm doing time for the other thing. And the judge this time decided to sentence me to the youth authority. So after I got done doing the 30 days for the county, I went to the state and ended up doing 12 months for them. And so, like I said, the idea here is that my attitude is bad and it's getting worse. If I put drugs in my system, I just bolster this negative, bad attitude that I have. And if I don't have any drugs, I'm just kind of a scared, spaced out speed freak, pretty much. And so the next few years were spent going in and out of jails, and it's just kind of on and on, ad nauseum, until 1973, after I was on parole. I got a new parole officer, and she decided I needed to go to a drug program. And there was a drug program in Metropolitan State Hospital, so I have been to a nut house. That's what you get if you have alcoholism. You go to jail, nut houses, or death. That's all we have to look forward to. And so I did 11 months in this program, which was a bunch of drug addicts who were trying to beat long cases. And what this was attack therapy, where people would sit around in a group of about 12, 15 people, and they had this thing called the game. And they called the game on, and when they did, everybody just picked on one person, and they just started beating you down emotionally, till you're just like, you're just a blithering idiot, pretty much. You know, you don't have any defenses, and then they start building you back up. This was the best therapy that they had for people with alcoholism and drug addiction during the late 60s, and it was like the latest thing. And all that did for me is just kind of toughened up my game, pretty much, and I learned how to keep people at bay. I learned how to do group, and so anyway, I finished that program, and I got out of there. You know, I got a job for the first time. I had a little apartment in Stanton, and I was self-supporting through my own contributions for the first time in my life. And I was doing pretty good. But in that program, they never said anything about alcohol. And I started drinking a few beers on the weekend. Really wasn't that big a deal, except that once in a while my brother would come by, or some of my old friends from up in Glendale, and they'd be doing the same thing, doing some drugs, and I'd try and drink and keep up with their drug use. And that doesn't really work too well when they're doing, some speed and that kind of stuff. And so I was, alcohol became a problem right during this time. And it's like not too long after this, I decided that I was going to move back. I was going to move down here to San Clemente, and I followed my parents down here. And when I moved into this town, I was bringing my stuff in the car and got pulled over by the cops for weaving, but I wasn't quite drunk enough to get a DUI, so they just kind of told me to watch myself and sent me on my way. And before long, I met a lady who had been in that drug program, and we ended up hooking up. And I was just looking for somebody for an apartment, really. And she was doing heroin, and of course I started doing a little heroin. I was never much of a heroin addict. I chased the stuff, but I could never really get the kind of money that I wanted to, that I needed to really get a good habit going. But I would have liked to have gotten good and loaded all the time, but I just couldn't quite get it together, So I'm a thief by now, and my scam is going into stores, stealing meat, and sticking it down my pants, and then going out. I'm a hamburglar, and so I'm pretty good at it, if I do say so myself, but not good enough to keep a good habit going. So I don't know. It's like a weird sort of a thing there. But so I'm doing these different things. I have no morals. Anybody who gets into a relationship with me finds out quite quickly that it's all about me, and I don't think anything about anybody else. And so people come and go in my life very quickly. And just about this time, I was starting to make the rounds of going in and out of alcoholic detoxes. There was quite a few around Orange County at the time. And my MO was, at this point, I was drinking a lot, partying a lot, but it was getting to the point that once I started drinking, I just could not stop. I picked up the first drink, I didn't know when I was going to be able to stop. And so it was kind of convenient because I could just turn myself into a detox. They would sober me up after a couple of days, and I would go into their recovery program, is usually what I would do. And I would be a star pupil for a little while, and they'd ask me, you know, to get a sponsor and go to meetings, and I'd say I'm taking applications, you know, and I'd just go to just enough meetings just to satisfy whatever they wanted me to do. And I might, like, go to the Connection on a Friday night, get loaded on heroin, and come back to the house and maybe be asked to lead an AA meeting. Or, you know, that happened before. And so I just really never got the concept of sobriety. You know, I just did not want to, I didn't want to get sober. I believed that this was my lifestyle and this was my lot in life, and I was just going to have to live it out. And I was pretty happy with that. You know, I was pretty comfortable. I mean, I wasn't comfortable, but I had been living this way so long that this was what I was used to, and it was the best that I thought my life could be, and it was just the way it is. And I got thrown out of one of those recovery houses one time, and I knew this lady that my mom knew her. My mom and her mom worked together, and this lady I got hooked up with, her mom was a friend of my mom's, and so I knew she had an apartment in Santa Ana. So I got thrown out of there, so I just went over there to visit her one day and moved in not too long after that, and just made her life miserable for the next 4 or 5 years. You know, her coming home from work and seeing a bunch of knuckleheads sitting around shooting drugs, and you know, it was just, she just wasn't used to that kind of stuff. But she was a trooper, and I guess she loved me enough to hang in there, because we eventually got married. But the end is coming here. Next couple of years were spent just trying different things to keep the probation officer off my back. I got involved with you know, the people I'm going around with were always going to the methadone clinic, and that's where I'd go to score sometimes. So I got on the methadone maintenance program, and I was on that for like 11 months. And basically what that did was I just doubled up on every kind of pill and every other kind of drug that I could get into my system. But my mind is getting, like, just shattered during these times. It's like, I can't keep jobs. I'm a machinist, but and they need people at work, but I'm just, like, I have trouble getting there. And when I get there, I'm, like, going into the bathroom all the time and having a few drinks of beer out of my backpack and sticking the empties down in the water in the toilet bowl, and you know, just it was just getting worse and worse as we're going along here. And what happened was I turned myself into one more detox. And what had happened a couple of days before that, I was just going down to the pier. I didn't have a job. I had fallen off a curb on the way to the methadone clinic one day. I had a broken arm, and I'm at my girlfriend's mom's house by now. We lost the apartment, and I'm drinking a little bit of her mom's booze in the morning to get the shakes down from the night before so that I can make it down to the pier to hang out and just drink through the day. And what I was doing was selling this skunk weed for $5 to the Marines to make enough money to drink through the day. And I was at that point one more time where I knew I needed to get sober. So I called my dad, and we called a place called the Casa del Cerro. Some of you guys remember that. It was a indigent detox that at this time it was over in Dana Point up on a hill. So I called there, and they said, come in the next day. And I went down to the pier the next morning and did my job, and I drank a fifth of white port, I remember. And I remember throwing up some beer I had drank earlier to get the white port down so that I could get the shakes down enough so that I could turn myself into the detox later on. And so my dad drove me up there, and he pushed me out and left me there. And I was like paranoid. I thought there was a guy who worked at the state park. He had an emblem on. I thought he was the cops, and I was trying to fight with him. And I'm like 115 pounds, you know, and just just a mess, and they did my detox or my intake up against the cabinets up there at the Casa del Cerro. And the next day I woke up, and I was grateful that I didn't have any like Librium. I usually took Librium with me when I went to detox or something to take the edge off the detox. But this time I didn't have anything, so I had to feel the full impact of that detox. And it wasn't the worst detox I'd ever had by any means. It was just, I just felt like shit. I was used to feeling like that for years, and it wasn't any big deal. But I got the right idea. I was going to go tell the counselor, I need to make some phone calls. You know, I got to get a hold of the probation officer, and I got to get a hold of that girlfriend who threw me out of her mom's house. And, you know, I got plans to make here. And he told me in no uncertain terms, you know, why don't you go back over in the house? You've been in and out of this place so many times, and, you know, it's time for you to do something with your life. Why don't you get that big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and start reading it? And I couldn't believe how he was talking to me, and I went back over to the house, and I did. I started reading the big book, and I started asking the counselors, you know, how do you do Alcoholics Anonymous? And they suggested going to 90 meetings in 90 days. And for me, that was like a spiritual beginning right there, because for me to ask anybody how to stay sober, for me to even get it in my psyche that I wanted possibly to stay sober was unbelievable for me, and I wasn't even aware of that at the time. But what I did do was I went and laid in my bed, and I put the big book up and was reading a Stephen King. That was about the best I could do. You know, I was like acting like I was getting with sobriety. And I got out of that detox after 7 days, and I turned myself into the little AA club that was over on Los Molinos, and I just parked myself there, and I asked a young guy to sponsor me, and that was the hardest thing I ever did, for me to make that long walk from one side of the room over to the other side of the room to ask this guy for some help was really, you know, just really hard for me. And I just started going to meetings, and we had meetings 3 times a day, and I went to, you know, I'm unemployable at this time. I've still got the broken arm. I think the cast had just been taken off. And so we started taking a crack at that step. So I got together with this guy, and the way we did it, just he would come and talk to me after the meeting. We talked for 5 minutes about a step, and then when we got to the fourth and fifth step, he took me over to his house, and he sat me down, and I started doing some writing about my character defects, my sex inventory, my the different things. But it was a different format, and there was a bunch of questions that he had me write about. And what it was supposed to show me was that what my character defects were, and also what my character assets were. But I felt so bad about myself. I had a list about this long of things that I thought that were good about me, and my bad things were like pages long. So I had a real problem with self-worth in early sobriety. But I got a little job changing tires, and got back together with that lady, and just started clicking along in sobriety. They asked me to do things, and it was just really nice to have people asking me to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was on a pink cloud, and it was just so nice to just not be looking over my shoulder for the first time in my life and worried about who's coming after me. And I started developing a relationship with the higher power when I remember my sponsor asking me, what's your idea of God? I kind of told him that I had when I was a kid, I wanted to believe in God when I was living with that aunt and uncle, and we went to church, and I kind of had an idea that there was some good feeling from a belief in a higher power. But I had squashed that when I started taking drugs and alcohol. And he said, well, that's good. Then you get to develop your idea of what a higher power is. And slowly, together with working the steps with him, that's what I've done. I celebrated a year of sobriety, and that that lady that I was still with and I got married right into there, and we moved over here on Paleo. And so this little block in this area around here was my AA world for the next AA for my AA sobriety. Coming to this meeting right here every Friday night. I was the secretary of this meeting in the 70s and, in the 80s. I got sober. I forgot to tell everybody. I've been sober since 1981. And I think it was like in 82 or 83, I was the secretary at this meeting. And there was a lot of young people that were coming into AA at that time. And we started having dances in this room, and we learned how to just have fun in sobriety. And we were raising money for the All California Young People's Convention, and we would donate that money to them, and they would have the convention, and all the young people would go to the convention where it was always at a different place, and that was really kind of cool. It was just all new to me. And life's clicking along. You're showing up to work on a regular basis, and they start promoting you and giving you more money. And I went back to school because I had been working in that trade off and on. As long as I had some drugs in me, you could put me in front of a machine and I could do what you wanted me to do, but just barely. So I had to I entered into a apprenticeship program, and I went to school for 4 years and worked for hours at my job, and I learned my trade, and like I said, started making money, started getting credit cards, started buying stuff, and that was a whole learning process in itself. I wasn't very responsible with money when I was out there drinking and using, and just because you get sober doesn't mean I was that much more responsible. So I'd like to talk about, I got to about 7 years of sobriety, and I came home one day, and my little brother was 2 years younger than me. He was always kind of like having a good time drinking and using, but it was getting kind of bad. It was kind of getting bad, and he was catching more cases. It was kind of getting like I was, but he was still, hanging in there with it. And he was doing some heroin, and he just got out of jail. And I picked him up, and I told him we'll go to some meetings together. I was trying to help him out. And I guess while he was in jail, he made some money, and then that. After he got out of jail, he went up and he got this money, and he went to the connections and got loaded, and they probably didn't work with him, and he died, and they found him behind a dumpster up in Santa Ana, and my sponsor told me about this. And that was like the first thing in my sobriety that was a big, it was like somebody punched me, when he told me that. I just couldn't believe. I loved my little brother, and I wasn't a very good brother to him through the years, but I tried to do the best that I could at the time. I was trying to be the best example in sobriety. But the thing that my sponsor told me is that people have to do that. The reason we have to stay here in Alcoholics Anonymous is because other people go and do that, so we can be an example for the people that are here, that we might be able to just touch that one person and keep them from going and doing the same thing that happened to my brother. And so Alcoholics Anonymous just was there for me for that, and my whole family. We had the service over here in the chapel, and my parents and I. We're just a basket case, but Alcoholics Anonymous just put us together and held us up like they do. And we got through that. I forget to mention, my parents got sober. My mom got sober before I did, in the care unit, quite a few years before I did, but didn't really like the meetings and stuff like that. So she started going to, she just didn't go to the program and start working a program. And after I got sober and I'm on fire for AA and I'm going to meetings and I'm, on that pink cloud, and she kind of saw a difference in me, she saw something and she decided that she was going to go back to meetings, and she did that, and she got involved with a woman's group and working steps and sponsoring people, and it was just really, really good for the whole family. My dad was sober. he would kind of had, he was periodic. Every once in a while he'd have like a weekend or something like that where he'd have a little problem and then he'd come back. But they were both sober when they died. My mom died a couple of years ago and my dad's been gone about 4 years or so. And so anyway, my life is just was just going along. It's just life on life's terms. I'm learning things. Lady that I got married to and I moved down to Oceanside and bought a house in the 90s, and it was hard to move from here, but where my foundation for sobriety was. But I asked somebody in the program if he knew anybody down there, and he hooked me up with a guy at the Thursday night meeting in Carlsbad. And so this guy was like 20 years sober, and so he was making coffee for the big Thursday night meeting, and I thought, well, that's kind of cool. So I asked him to be my sponsor, and he's been my sponsor ever since. And he's just a great guy. And this, I can't say enough about sponsorship. The people that are new tonight, I can't figure out things on my own. I just do not do well, and I kind of need to bounce things off of somebody else when I'm not thinking too well. And I still have thoughts that aren't too clear sometimes. And my sponsor is the kind of guy that when you call him up, he'll give you some information, but pretty much he just tells me the same things that he's told me in the past over and over. So I have the answers before I actually call him. But sometimes it's just good to hear him say it to me. And he knows me well enough so that he knows, okay, you're kind of off base here. Or maybe you want to look at things a little bit differently. And for me to have the willingness to listen to somebody and not get pissed off, that's the grace of God working in my life today. And I still have the willingness to do that on a regular basis. And life kind of fell apart at 13 years in that came home. Our finances were all screwed up. We had bought that house at the height of the 90s when it was really expensive, and it's just like now. The bottom fell out, and we ended up losing that house. And I came home one Friday night, and they said, this house belongs to Fannie Mae. Would you please move out? And so I just went, and I picked up some cigarettes, and I started smoking for a couple of years. And that relationship hadn't been that good for a long time, and I'd been working with my sponsor on that. It was more than just not good. It just, there just wasn't any love there anymore. So we decided to separate, and I decided to get a divorce. And so I was sober around Alcoholics Anonymous. I moved back down here into my parents' house for a very short period of time. At 40 years old, that's a big mistake, let me tell you. Just listen to those two go back and forth. It was unbelievable. I had to get out quick. So I moved up the street here where Lisa knows the lady that's living. And I got an apartment, and I just got back into going to this meeting and helping newcomers and throwing people in the car and going to meetings. And, one more time, Alcoholics Anonymous was there for me when I was at a low point in my life. It's always been here for me when I'm at any sort of a low point in my life. And I was dating around here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't even know what to say about that. It was it was grueling sometimes. I was here in this meeting, though, after a couple of years of dating, I think I was about 5 years I was single. And some of you know me here. I kind of stick my nose in things around here. Some lady came up and walked up to me, and she said, I want to pay for a book, and you look like somebody that can take some money out for some reason. So we started talking, and she is a social worker. And so she said she has these patients, and she'd like to know how to help them, and she'd like to find some information about the steps. So she said, would you like to talk to me about that? And so we decided to go out to eat, and we went out to eat, and we're talking about that. And it came to time to pay, and there wasn't anything really there. I had kind of given up looking for a relationship around here. And I said, well, you know what, okay, I'll pay this time, and you can pay next time. I don't know what I was thinking, but I've been paying ever since. And she's the most wonderful person, though. It was just one of those things that was just meant to be. It took me a year or so to figure that out. But we did get married after about a year and a half, and we've been married now for 10 years. And it's just hard to have a social worker in the house. It's like a it's like a counselor all the time. And she stays out of my business very well, but she has this ability to be able to, when I'm getting with that alcoholic thinking and sort of getting skewed in the way I'm looking at things, she has a way of kind of pointing this out to me in a counselor sort of way that makes you feel good, but makes the point come home that you're kind of looking at things bad. And that's been really beneficial. But a lot of it's not like a sponsor, though. You don't really, I resent it when she says it. My sponsor can tell me, but it's not okay when she does sometimes. But like I said, my life's really good today. We ended up buying another little house, and I was totally against that. But one more time, I'm in the middle of that place where the economy has made me wonder if some of these decisions I've made with finances were all that good. But really, all that stuff doesn't matter, and that's what I come back to all the time. The material stuff really doesn't matter. I have a peace in my heart most of the time that I just, you know, wouldn't trade anything for. I just feel comfortable most of the time. Like I said, I had these problems with self-confidence, but today I feel like I can do my job. I've been working at the same place for 23 years. I kind of just feel confident in what I do. I feel confident in my relationships. I feel like my higher power is going to help me through whatever's going to come down the pike. And, after going through different heavy things in sobriety, you kind of come to the realization that there can't be anything too big that we can't handle together here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, my friend Rick was talking to me tonight, and I just pray for what's going on with him. But what I've learned around here is that's what you do. We just tell each other what's going on. We get close to each other. You know, we cut right to the chase with whatever it is that's happening with each other, and we try and bolster each other up and support each other through whatever we're going through. And it wasn't like that out there on the streets. I every once in a while I get on classmates and I try and find somebody, and I think, what the hell are you doing? Those people never wanted to know what happened to you after high school or anything like that. But the people in Alcoholics Anonymous do care, and we'll go through hell with you to help you stay sober. If you don't want to stay sober, you know, we'll have to draw the line somewhere. But if you show a sincere desire to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and do the things that we do around here, we'll do anything we can to be helpful to you. And what I'm going through right now is one of these things where it's my time in life to try and be helpful to my wife's mom. And, I'm a self-centered, still egotistical alcoholic, and I want to do what I want to do some days. But Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to try and be helpful to another person, and that's what we're doing right now. She's like 87 years old, and we asked her not to drive anymore. Actually, her friends came to us and pleaded with us to tell her to not drive anymore. So I've been driving her around, and I don't tell you that because it's not very humble of me to say that. I'm just saying that this is what I've learned how to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We be of service, and when we are asked to speak, when the speaker doesn't show up, you get up here and you do the best you can. And I am kind of running out of things, and I know there were several things I wanted to hit on. I just can't say enough for the people that are new here in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't think that you're an alcoholic, like they say, belly up to the bar and have a few drinks. And if you can do that, I'll take my hat off to you. I'll buy a hat. And if you can drink, more power to you. You know, I don't begrudge people being able to go out there and have fun. You know, it was a real eye-opener, the first concert I went to, and somebody toked up, and I started, wow, I forget people, people can still get high and have a good time out there, but you can't, I said to myself. Oh, yeah, okay. And if you're having problems with your drinking, and it seems like that when you start drinking and you can't stop, or if you can stop for a while, and then you feel uncomfortable while you're not drinking, chances are there might be a problem there. And we'll always be here. Alcoholics Anonymous will be here to help if you need us. I said we'll go home early tonight, and that's it. Thanks for listening.